And now, the early music show, introduced by Lucy Skeeping.
We're used to hearing quite a bit about music making in 18th century London, which isn't surprising since it was the biggest city in Europe at the time. But what was going on elsewhere in the country during this period? These were the early years of the Industrial Revolution, of the rapid rise of cities in the Midlands, where a newly emerging middle class was on the lookout for the latest forms of cultural entertainment. And for many, that meant high-quality music. So, today on the Early Music Show, we're going to step outside London to investigate the music scene in Birmingham and its environs in the late 1700s. And to help us, I'm joined by my studio guest, Martin Perkins, Head of Early Music at Birmingham Conservatoire at Birmingham City University and co-director of the ensemble, which goes by the lovely name of the Musical and Amicable Society. Welcome, Martin. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Now, this really is an interesting area to explore, not least because I know you're going to be introducing us to some British composers whose music is rarely heard these days. But before we chat, let's hear an example of one of them, a charming little song by John Pixall, who was vicar of Edgbaston during the second half of the 18th century. It welcomes the robin whose warbling tones bring delight to the snowy winter months. Louise Wayman is the singer. This is An Invitation to the Redbreast by John Pixall.
And more than wind's tale.
An Invitation to the Redbreast by John Pixel. The soprano Louise Wayman with the Musical and Amicable Society, whose founder director Martin Perkins is my guest today. Martin, with your ensemble, you've been focusing on an area of British music that I'm afraid these days doesn't always get the attention it deserves. That is music making in and around Birmingham in the late 1700s. So what brought you to all that in the first place?
Well, I'm very interested in the music that surrounds me, as it were, and having Birmingham as my adopted home for the last 20 years, some time ago I decided to try and delve into the history, particularly the 18th century, which is where most of my performing has been recently. So I discovered all of these names, very unusual and not at all known to me before, and realised that there was a wealth of repertoire out there.
Was this sort of interest in culture in the late 1700s, was this quite a new thing? I mean, was it to do with the sort of people who are now beginning to base themselves in the area?
Well, it really goes hand in hand with the Industrial Revolution. And as you mentioned in your introduction, Birmingham really flourished during the 18th century. And from about 3,000 people at the end of the 17th century, to over 70,000 by 1801. And so, obviously, with that, audiences responded and became interested along the way.
Were these high-quality performances? I mean, did all the best musicians sort of come up from London, or there was a bit of a homegrown crowd there too?
There was a very mixed scenario. We have quite run-of-the-mill type concerts, but throughout the century, we start to see more and more emphasis on the quality of the performance. So, for example, an advert for a concert might say, an agreeable band will be procured for this occasion. And then towards the end of the 18th century, we actually start seeing named musicians.
Well, we're going to hear some instrumental music now, a concerto by another churchman, the preacher Richard Mudge. What's his backstory?
Well, Mudge came to the Midlands in 1741, when he was appointed curate at a little village in between Birmingham and Coventry called Packington. Now, Packington was the seat of the Earls of Aylesford, and it appears that the Aylesfords were very interested in music, and they cultivated Mudge's interest and experience. Mudge's circle included Charles Jennens, who was, of course, the collaborator with Handel on oratorio such as The Messiah.
So it's possible just that Mudge may have actually met Handel at some point.
Yes, there's certainly anecdotal evidence that the two met. And when you consider that all of Handel's manuscripts ended up with Jennens after his death and then ended up at the Earls of Aylesford's house, then, yes, the influence on Mudge must have been huge.
So what we're going to hear is a concerto grosso, one of a set of six published in 1749. Now, this is a form that's particularly suitable, isn't it, for a sort of mix of technical abilities, so you get professionals playing aside amateurs, perhaps, who aren't quite so good at playing.
Yes, the concerto grosso was very popular in England in the 18th century, and part of its popularity was due to the fact that it was written in such a way that typically you have two solo violin parts, which are quite hard, and then we have two ripieno violin parts, which the lesser experienced players...
And the amateurs, I guess.
And the amateurs, of course, yes.
Thank you.
Music by the Birmingham-based composer Richard Mudge, Concerto No. 2, performed by Baroque Orchestra Capriccio Basel, directed from the violin by Dominic Kiefer. Now, our next composer was quite a mover and shaker in the very centre of Birmingham. Joseph Harris was an organist, wasn't he?
That's right, yes. He was organist at St Martin's from about 1771. And of all the composers that we're hearing today, he represents the new generation. He's got a definite pre-classical style rather than the Baroque style that we've heard from Mudge and Pixel. Not only a church musician, but he was an active freelance teacher and performer, and amongst his pupils was the daughter of the celebrated industrialist Matthew Boulton.
Because, of course, this was the time when, I guess, although they were in the Midlands, these families wanted to feel they were getting everything that the South, London, had to offer as well.
Yes, unlike the landed families who also had homes in London that they could disappear to for the season, the wealthy merchants didn't have that luxury. They needed the culture to come to them.
It's nice to think they didn't just sort of pay their ticket and go and hear professionals, but they made music themselves so much as well.
That's right. It was an integral part of their life.
Well, we're going to hear another song now, again sung by Louise Wayman with your own ensemble. What are the musical influences? It's quite a fun piece, these little pizzicatos.
Yes, the late 18th century composers are starting to introduce a lot more colour. The idea, the whole concept of orchestration is now on the cards. Interestingly, we also have an obbligato harpsichord part, not just a mere continuo accompaniment.
Very reminiscent to me when I listen to it of, say, Haydn and possibly Mozart, this sort of operatic style.
Yes, the vocal part particularly is very operatic, and it's very reminiscent of works perhaps by Johann Christian Bach, who was moving and shaking in London at the time. Thank you.
Muse beloved, Calliope divine, a pastoral invocation in praise of the musical deities, written by Joseph Harris. Louise Waymans, the singer, with the Musical and Amicable Society, directed from the harpsichord by Martin Perkins, who's my studio guest today. You're listening to the Early Music Show here on BBC Radio 3 with me, Lucy Skeeping. And we're looking at some of the composers who were popular in and around the Birmingham area. Martin, I like the name of your ensemble, the Musical and Amicable Society. I hope you're all friends.
Yes, it's a really interesting name, isn't it? But it's actually an original 18th century name for a music society that was formed in Birmingham in the 1760s. Now, most music societies were called just the Musical Society at so-and-so. This one seems to have highlighted its social aims as well as its musical ones.
Well, our next composer is a fellow called Barnabas Gunn. His life centred around the Church of St Philip, which I'm informed is now Birmingham Cathedral. I think there was some controversy at the time about his composition style. Tell us about that.
Yes, Gunn was a very interesting chap. He was the first organist at the Cathedral of St Philip's. But by all accounts, he was a cantankerous fellow. In fact, after the publication of his first collection of songs, William Hayes, who was the professor of music at Oxford, so the highest authority in the land on compositional method, issued his own pamphlet that ran to 32 pages in which he lampooned Gunn's collection of songs. Hayes's collection was called The Art of Composing Music by a Method Entirely New, Suited to the Meanest Capacity.
That's terrible.
And it goes on. He indicated that the best way of composing music was by a newly invented machine called the Spruzzarino, which randomly squirted ink at the music. But Gunn was obviously somebody that had a sense of humour and also saw a business opportunity. For the very next year, he reissued his collection of songs, in fact calling them Gunn's 12 English Songs by the Newly Invented Method of Composing with the Spruzzarino.
Ah, that's a nice story. Well, this little flute sonata that we're going to hear was published in 1745, perhaps a little derivative at times, but I think it's rather pleasing. And I can certainly see how it must have been very popular for domestic music making, particularly the last of the four movements, which is a very spirited little jig.
Thank you.
Rachel Latham, the flautist there with the Musical and Amicable Society, directed by Martin Perkins, playing solo number 4 in B minor for flute and basso continuo by Barnabas Gunn. Calling Gunn a composer of the meanest capacity, as Hayes did, sounds a bit unfair. Did anybody support the chap?
Well, he must have had supporters because he was very active in Birmingham after that and had a concert career and lots of pupils. In fact, there's an interesting letter from one of his pupils to a friend of hers. It reads this: "I have sent for the pamphlet that is wrote against Mr. Gunn's compositions. As he's my master, I have a curiosity to it. I can't tell you what genius he has for composing music, but certainly he's a very good music master. As a companion, I do not much admire him. I think he's a disagreeable man, very mercenary, always full of esteem for himself and of contempt for all others, and does not consider that it is almost as glorious to acknowledge merit in other persons as to have it oneself. But he sets good lessons, so I will bear with him."
I think I've gone right off him, actually. Now, our next Midlands composer rather confused me at first because his name's Jeremiah Clarke.
Yes, not to be confused with Jeremiah Clarke with an E, the contemporary of Henry Purcell. No, our Jeremiah Clarke of Worcester and Birmingham definitely spelt his name without an E at the end of Clarke.
Now, he organised all sorts of events around the area of Birmingham, didn't he? He really got things going.
That's right. He had what we might call today a portfolio career. He started off musical life at Worcester Cathedral, where he was a chorister, and soon after started putting on concerts in Worcester and the surrounding area, until his appointment at Birmingham in 1765 as organist of St Philip's. He was a teacher, taught at the local school, had private pupils. He played the violin in many subscription concerts all around the Midlands region, and notably, he started putting on his own benefit concerts.
And that was a really good excuse to get his own music performed, I guess.
Yes, there's an interesting concert that he put on in 1798 to celebrate the victories over the French by Admirals Lord Duncan and Nelson, in which he performed his own constitutional ode, sadly now lost. Towards the end of his life, Clarke carries on performing around the region, and notably he appears at the Three Choirs Festivals of Worcester, Gloucester and Hereford. And after his tenure at Birmingham had finished, he became the director of music at Worcester, coinciding with the year that Worcester was hosting the Three Choirs. So he gained a really important position right at the end of his life.
Well, the text of this song of Clarke's, To Myra, it's called, it seemed a little reminiscent in tone of Gather Ye Rosebuds from the previous century, which is one of my favourite songs, except here we have much more of a kind of Arcadian theme. And the poet is a bit kinder, telling the young lady that as age fades her beauty, she should improve her mind, which is, I think, rather a modern sentiment.
Thank you.
See, Myra, see the lily fair, the blushing rose just newly blown. Then view thy lovely face, and there you'll find that beauty's all your own. The song To Myra by Jeremiah Clarke of Worcester, not to be confused with a contemporary of Purcell, born some 70 years earlier. Well, Martin, time's almost up, I'm afraid. We've almost reached our final music. We've heard some really lovely pieces. I don't know about the listeners, but I have to say every single piece was new to me, as were many of the composers. Why do you think they've been overlooked for so long? I mean, is it that much of the music was aimed at amateurs and therefore perhaps it wasn't always so well performed?
Well, there's an element of London-centric in our research over the last few decades. But the last few years has seen many such pieces of music from not only the Midlands but in the northeast and northwest come to light, and a lot of it is really good stuff.
And is there more to discover?
There's plenty more out there. There are musicians that were associated with cities all around the Midlands, Lichfield, Gloucester, Hereford, all with lots of music that we still haven't really discovered and haven't heard for a very long time.
And so much of it really does give us a sense of the sort of people who played it, the sort of people who listened to it in those days. I mean, it's a really strong vibe, isn't it?
Yes, we get a sense that the composers were writing for their market, and that really gives us a really good indication of exactly who these people were, who made the music, who listened to it, and the interaction between them and the composer.
Well, we have another concerto grosso to end, and it's by a composer who seems to have been responsible for founding the Birmingham Festival. Of course, Birmingham at that time was still rapidly expanding, wasn't it?
Yes, that's right. There's certainly a distinction to be made between concerts that are put on for the benefit of the composer and those that are put on for a higher, worthier cause. And in the 1760s, we see Capel Bond putting on concerts in order to fundraise for the General Hospital in Birmingham, which hadn't quite been built and was still lacking in funds. And this gave rise to what in the 19th century was called the Birmingham Triennial Festival.
Well, we're going to hear something by Capel Bond. Again, I think there are lots of influences that I certainly noticed, that Handel, Boyce, Corelli.
Absolutely, yes. It's really good, meaty, Baroque English music. And very unlike the Clark and the Harris that we heard earlier, it's really rooted in that Handelian style.
Very confident writing, isn't it?
Yes, particularly because it features the trumpet as the solo instrument. And interestingly, one can't help but think that there's some influence going on from Mudge, who we heard earlier. His set of concertos also starts with a trumpet concerto.
Oh, maybe there was one particular star trumpeter in the area.
Yes, it's tantalising, isn't it? One wonders who this performer, this virtuosic performer, was. Maybe one day I'll find out.
More research needed.
Yeah. Thank you.
The trumpeter Crispian Steele Perkins with the Parley of Instruments, conducted by Roy Goodman, in the first of the six concertos in seven parts by Capel Bond. And it ends this week's Early Music Show, exploring the music scene in 18th century Birmingham. Lucy Skeeping's studio guest was the head of early music at Birmingham Conservatoire at Birmingham City University, Martin Perkins. Details of the music in today's programme can be found on the Early Music Show page of the Radio 3 website.